This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this day after a middle-of-the-week Christmas, we know many of you are still home taking a holiday pause, while many of you, including me, are back at work looking ahead to next year fast upon us. We begin today with a story of 2013 about the power of love that not even an act of Congress could deny. The U.S. Supreme Court on June 26th of this year ruled that the love and freedom of 84-year-old Edie Windsor was something that was protected in the U.S. Constitution. Back in 2007, Edie Windsor married Thea Speier, her partner of more than 40 years, in Ontario, Canada, something she could not legally do in the United States, partly because of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, passed by Republicans and Democrats in a very different political time in America during the 1990s. But when Thea died in 2009, she left her estate to Windsor, and Windsor tried to claim a federal estate tax spousal exemption. But because of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, the government claimed that Windsor owed thousands of dollars in estate taxes because her marriage was not recognized. Windsor sued, claiming that the Defense of Marriage Act violated the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. Edie Windsor took on the U.S. government and won last June in a 5-4 decision. We begin with the love story of a talented, bright star who rose in the world despite her sexual orientation, who spent most of her life in the closet, but when she directed her intelligence, wit, and determination on the U.S. Supreme Court, she became a star who changed the world for millions of Americans.
It's like there's a huge love affair between me and the whole gay community. And I can't walk down the street without people stopping me to say thank you. It's thrilling.
Did you ever expect that you would be such a symbol?
No, not at all. At some point I had said to Thea, you know, oh, God, look what we've accomplished. What would have happened if we hadn't used up so much energy just being hidden? And first she said, oh, that's, you know, it doesn't bother me at all. By the time we were through talking, we were both crying. So I already understood what, you know, the price we paid. And yet we had a very good life. We were wildly in love and stayed that way.
Tell me about your courtship.
Well, it didn't even exist at first. I mean, we met, we danced together. We then danced together from time to time as we met at parties. She was always with someone.
She was the first lesbian dancer, you said, who knew how to...
Who could really lead. And that mattered. That did matter. but other than that, there was about 2 years went by where we were nothing else to each other except people who danced together when they met at parties. And then we began seriously dating. And then we became engaged in 1967.
And still, the hiding went on, even though, as far as you were concerned.
Yes, so we had a world in which we were not hidden, you know, a gay world. And then we both had some friends who were straight and who knew, but it was never explicit. Okay.
Speaking of explicit, you're a very sexual person, right?
Yes, and certainly was with her.
And to the point that your lawyer even advised you, you know, stop talking so much about sex.
Don't talk about sex,
right.
Yes.
But in some ways, your exploration and freedom about sex mirrors the freedom that you demanded in this court case. Do you think sex and freedom go together?
Probably. Okay, mostly. And yet, I think if you're in love, sex is there, and it doesn't have to do with freedom or not freedom. If you have to be free to be in love, then that's true.
But there's certainly something about your relationship with Thea that liberated you.
Yes. Yeah, completely.
What was that?
I think we were so pleased with each other, so we had to be pleased with ourselves. It made for not feeling hidden even when we were. I know, at IBM, I never told anybody I worked with, and we were all very close. We were a strange group, but we were all friends. And we had lunch together. We drank together after work. Except I didn't go anywhere with them on weekends. And most people did not realize I was gay until our wedding appeared in the New York Times. And then people called up and said, you lied. Edie, you lied. Okay. And I said, I had to.
Why did you get married in Canada?
Pardon me?
Why did you get married in Canada?
Oh, there was nowhere else. Okay, we waited. We really were waiting for New York, but we waited for New Jersey. We waited for Connecticut. Massachusetts, you know, you had to be a resident. We weren't ready to leave New York. And I had asked her, you know, did you want to go to Canada? And by then she was fairly crippled with MS. And she said, not really, but if you want to, you know, if it matters to you, we'll do it. But then what happened is she had a lousy prognosis. And she got up the morning after they said, you know, probably a year to go. And she said, you still want to get married? And I said, yes, I do. And she said, me too. And we went with two best men and four best women, all of whom had functions to deal with, okay, the equipment that was missing.
Wheelchairs,
okay, somebody
walkers,
to
scooters,
lift her, somebody for carrying her, somebody to hold her hand out so I could put a ring on it.
So you were domestic partners.
Yeah.
And it just felt like a disappointment.
It didn't. It was nothing. It didn't matter. It was a symbol of who we were to each other. I mean, no question. And we loved it that everybody was sweet, you know, and we had big bouquets and what have you. But it wasn't the same as the morning after we got married, okay, and woke up. There's a profundity that it probably goes with the word even altogether. But I think it's much more so for those of us who really thought we could never have it. So, yeah, we were a little delirious, and it was an extra thrill, but it is different. And I ask every single long-range couple who has gotten married since it's been possible, did it feel different the next morning? And every single couple says yes. Mm. Okay.
Can you describe the moment when you understood the discrimination that was being forced upon you after Thea's death, and the moment that you decided, all right, we're taking this all the way?
Well, I think I always knew it. And I was one of the people who, when we bought our apartment, which grew in value over 40 years, incredibly. But when we bought it, I was very careful to make sure we each wrote half the amount in the checks. Not only that, I saved the check, the records. Okay, I saved the list of each of our things. Okay, because I knew someday they're going to ask me to prove where the money came from.
So you're not an ideal plaintiff. You're a dream plaintiff. You had all the documents, all the check stubs.
Yeah. But that was for when they say, hey, you have to pay for everything. Okay, we wouldn't have to. Mm.
So when did you think this was going to the Supreme Court?
Shortly after the appeals court. The appeals court was the glorious surprise. There were three judges, one of whom, a very conservative guy, the Chief Justice, and a Clinton appointment and a Obama appointment. The Clinton appointment wrote something like 43 pages in dissent, and the conservative Chief Justice wrote the most gorgeous, more giving, and more open than the Supreme Court.
Were you comfortable during the arguments in the Supreme Court?
Yes, completely, completely.
But there must have been something intimidating about United States versus Windsor.
But the first time I saw it, it was terrifying. The United States, it wasn't the United States versus Windsor to start. But initially it was Edie Windsor versus the United States of America. And I panicked for a moment. And then it was okay. And, of course, very soon, you know, the president and the Justice Department announced that they would no longer defend that law because they agreed with me that it was not constitutional. So that was a big help.
What did you feel like during those arguments? Did you feel the court was with you? Did you feel the justices were with you as you looked from face to face?
That's hard to say. I felt they were very fair and very respectful, which surprised me. Of course, the four liberal justices were obviously on our side. Pretty much you could count on that. And then Justice Kennedy, at some point in the middle of the thing, he made a reference to 40,000 kids in California. And I thought, oh, God, we have it made. I mean, he was defending the need, okay, for marriage.
Was Thea there in
absolutely,
court?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, people ask that, and I thought, what a silly question. But yes, she was. Actually, I find notes from time to time. I find various things in drawers all over the apartment. And I came home, and I swear to you that it was the day that of the oral arguments at the Supreme Court that I found a note that said, you did it, honey. Congratulations. Okay, from her. Now, she hadn't been able to write for years. So I assume it was probably something like when I stopped smoking. But you know, I thought I was spooked. Okay, I have this note.
And she's still talking to you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think she would be thrilled. Okay. One, she would be very happy that I'm out there and happy, because what this business of this love affair with the gay community is makes me a very happy girl. And you know, if you have to survive a great love of your life, it's a wonderful way to do it. It really is.
Well, Edie Windsor, thanks so much.
And thank you so much for having me.
Edie Windsor was the plaintiff in U.S. v. Windsor, the Supreme Court case that struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.